Okay, we're gonna go ahead and get started. Can I have everyone find their seats, please? Thank you. Welcome to session number 352, Sun Talks, Bridging the Gap Between Old and New Belief. This is a new format that we're trying this year, and it is definitely new for us, so we're trying to figure out how to sort of emulate TED-style talks in a Sunstone format. If you're not familiar with TED-style talks, they are very popular online. They're sort of condensed 15-minute, really tech-heavy, inspirational talks that are meant to be fast and condensed and informative, and they're wildly popular, like I said, online. So we're going to try to evolve in that direction with this particular session. And so if you're expecting like actual TED Talks, you need to be patient. I can barely plug in my computer. So if we do this again next year, we're going to hope to evolve to be super awesome like TED. So I really appreciate this year. I have recruited some of my best friends to help me with this. So I apologize to them. And I just want to say thank you to them because they take my crazy ideas that we've never even done before, and they put faith in them, and then they invest in them, and they've helped me out. So I really, really appreciate that. So today we're going to be doing our TED-style talks, and they're going to be short. And then afterwards, we're going to do a Q&A. And I would just ask everyone to behave beforehand because I am both moderating and speaking, and I don't have time to moderate everybody. So everyone behave today. Okay. Thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and give the biographies of all these fantastic people. I think most of them do not need an introduction, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. First of all, one of my dear, dear friends, John Larson. He is the executive director of the Whitefields Education Foundation and the host of the Mormon Expression podcast. John is a seventh-generation member of the LDS Church with Utah roots. He served his mission in San Diego, California, among the Laotian refugees, and has a lifelong interest in Mormon studies, particularly Mormon history, culture, and doctrine. John graduated from BYU with a BA in linguistics and from Weber State University with an MBA. John took the journey out of Mormonism about 10 years ago, and he has a heart of gold. I love this man. Then we have Geraldine Poole, who is also a good friend of mine, so good that she's sleeping in my toddler's bed tonight. Right? That's not as seedy as it sounds, I promise. Geraldine Poole is a graphic designer and Feminist Mormon Housewives permablogger. She also moderates the Feminist Mormon Housewives Society Facebook page. She also enjoys serving candlestick salad to missionaries and creatively feeding them to her five children. And she is the famous presenter of the famous food panel that went on yesterday, I guess. Or Thursday, yeah. It's become a thing now. So, myself, my name is Lindsay Hansen-Park, and I'm the Marketing and Communications Director for Sunstone. A lot of people don't know that I work for Sunstone, but I do. It's an actual job. And I speak for Sunstone. I'm also the founder of the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast, and I blog under the name of Winterbuzz for feministmormonhousewives.org. I'm also the Director of Counseling Services for Whitefields with John Larson, and I participate in just a lot of ways around Mormon studies. And my family and I live in Sansbury Park, Utah. And then I'm so happy to introduce for the first time someone you might not have heard of. Her name is Kate Kelly. And she is also just a wonderful, wonderful person. She's an international human rights attorney and one of the founding mothers of Ordained Women. She was raised Mormon, but was recently excommunicated from the LDS Church for raising questions about gender-based discrimination in the church, a decision which I reject personally. That's not in there, but that's what I said. She is an intuitive feminist and dedicated to faith-affirming direct action to increase gender equality in the church and society. And like I said, just a wonderful human being. So we're going to go ahead and get started with John Larson. And like I said, we're going to have questions at the end. Thank you.
Hello. My name's John. In the 10 years or so that I've been working with Mormons and ex-Mormons, there's been two questions that have interested me more than any others. The first is, why do some struggle after they leave the church and others just walk away? And the second question is, why do some believe in the church and stay? Or I should say, why do some not believe in the church and stay in the church? These two struggles with identity have been very curious to me as I've talked to people and spent a lot of time with them. And it's led me to the contemplation of the role of identity and how we see ourselves in relationship to the church and to the world, and how that affects what we do when we leave the church or we otherwise transition our faith. The church itself has struggled with identity. And in my contemplation, there have been two major identity crises that have happened in the church. The first was post-polygamy. Once polygamy was sort of gutted and the Senate took it apart with the Smoot hearings, the church was left to say, who are we? How do we identify ourselves as being other from the Christian world and from the rest of humanity? And there was a transitional period where we sort of took on American identity and became really sort of uber super Americans. Then something happened across the United States during the 1960s into the 70s with the counter-revolution, at which time the church was forced to have a second reevaluation of their identity. And they entered into what I call the golden age of Mormonism, because with Benson and other conservatives, the church teaching at the time dovetailed into a hyper-conservative view that many Americans were adopting at the time, a counter-revolution. And I read one time, I don't know if it's true, but the BYU was the only university to have a pro-Vietnam rally during the Vietnam War. And it gave a good sense of identity. But the problem is, things moved on. Many of the ideals of the counter-revolution seeped into our culture and became mainstream American. And today we're dealing with the aftermath of that. The church has not found, in my opinion, its new identity outside of that counter-counterculture, that hyper-conservatism. And what we have is we have been taken instead to move our identity into that of the correlated corporate-driven church. And this identity is one that might resonate with the bottom line in terms of growing numbers and growing revenue and following a corporate paradigm that many who go through MBA or accounting schools know and can speak. But for an individual seeking to identify themselves in the world, this is not very satisfying. And it's led people to wonder who they are. We actually had a lot of Mormon identity. I was born in 1973 and was raised in the church in the 70s and early 80s. And the church at that time was starting to slip away after the correlation kind of kicked off in 1961. But even when I was young, the church had bazaars and fairs and primary parades and quilting bees and road shows and stake farms and stake camps. And there was the building fund. People would actually build the buildings. And there was so much ownership and identity into who we were. And with this corporate-driven agenda, because we're looking at bottom line and bottom numbers, we've moved slowly away and dismantled those. Just like I have the Relief Society building here that stands in a monument to the fact that the Relief Society is no longer independent as it was today out in Temple Square. This same wave we're riding with America in general. Of course, the image on the left is from Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which America itself has started to move away from a community where we would have bowling leagues and the Lions Club and many, many things like that. But technologically, we're becoming more and more isolated. What that means for the individual is the individual is forced to find an identity of their own, awash in so many identities that it just becomes overwhelming. We encounter what's referred to as the paradox of choice. The paradox of choice is if you go into a grocery store and there's two yogurts, blueberry and strawberry, you'll pick the one you like better and you'll be very happy with that choice. If you go into the grocery store and there's 27 yogurts, the odds are that the one you come away with you'll have less satisfaction with because the probability that you made the wrong choice increases. And in America today, for an educated middle-class person, you can literally do anything. And this leaves people with a crisis of identity because you're leaving millions and millions of opportunities on the table every single day. Hence, religion and things like it give us a lot of sense of identity and sense of purpose, one by narrowing down the choice set, and the other by providing all these things, such as quilting bees, that can tell us who we are and where we stand in relationship to everything else. In dealing with ex-Mormons in particular, those who struggle, I've determined, one of the marking factors of them is that they took the religion serious. I was in a debate about 8 years ago with an apologist, and the apologist said to me at the time, he said, you know what your problem is you're taking all this way too seriously. And it kind of annoyed me at the time, but as I've contemplated that all the years, he was exactly right. That many of the people who are the so-called ex-Mormons, the people out on the internet creating a big ballyhoo, recording podcasts or whatever they do, are people who took religion far, far too seriously. And because that was part of their identity, because they drew their identity from being not only just Mormon, but being a really good Mormon, which means being a better Mormon than everybody else sitting next to them. So they take that same mode of thinking and that same mode of action and they just flip it on its head. The ex-Mormons and the Mormons are the same people. And this is why recently I've talked about the second identity transformation that the ex-Mormons need to go through. They need to become ex-Mormon if that's their path, and then they need to become an ex-ex-Mormon because they need to abandon that line of thinking. Because as we're talking about here, they just take that identity and they shift it. Their identity is as much driven by the church as an ex-Mormon as it was driven as a Mormon. In fact, oftentimes more so. Ex-Mormons will tell you oftentimes that they study the church more, that they start listening to conference again, and they start doing these things because they're paying attention to it. And it's not because they love the theology. It's the rare ex-Mormon that does. There are some who really are fascinated by it. But it's more because now their identity is driven by the Mormon church more so than it ever was when they were actually believers. So they face this same second crisis. Because the question I brought up in the beginning is why do some leave and others stay? Many will tell you, well, there's all this information on the internet. And there's all these new things coming out that we're learning about. In my esteem, there's nothing new that hasn't been around that will tell you the church is a faith-based system as opposed to a logical system, or in my view, that the church is not true or not what it purports to be. All that stuff has been around since Athens in 500 years before Christ. You can dismantle faith based on things that are age-old. And the criticisms that were given about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon have been around since the 1830s. The things that empower people to leave the church today are the same things that have been empowering people to leave the church for 170 years. The internet is here, that's true, but people don't really, in my esteem, leave the church because they stumbled on something. They usually are dissatisfied in an identity crisis and go looking for something new, and now they're able to find it. So fundamentally, it's about identity. So as these individuals start looking for identity, what is it that we're trying to solve? What is the problem here? And I've narrowed it down to three things that need to happen, whether one stays in the church as a liberal, one stays in the church as a believer, or one leaves the church. And that's finding an identity. When one goes through a major crisis like this, the first thing that one is presented with is crafting a new identity. And this is what the ex-Mormons are doing. They're trying to craft an identity as an ex-Mormon to make sure that nobody knows, that everybody knows what underwear they're wearing, right? The ex-Mormons are really concerned about that. So they have to craft a new identity. They have to find things. And there's three things that I found that really help this. One is finding a community. The unfortunate thing about leaving the church, about being excommunicated or whatever happens, is you lose your community. And that's the most devastating blow. You lose your friends, you lose your family. And so the first thing that needs to happen is one needs to find a community, and it doesn't matter what the community is. It can be Harley Davidson or Dungeons and Dragons or whatever it is that appeals to you, but you need to find that sense of who I am outside of this church. You need to find a purpose or a cause. You need to find something that makes you tick. For some people, it's their career, and bless them. For others, it's, I don't know, orange is the new black. Whatever is your thing, you need to find that and be driven towards that. And then the last thing is finding one's own self in those things and being able to actualize yourself in the moment. I'd like to end with this quote by Viktor Frankl. Viktor, of course, was a survivor of the Holocaust and wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning. For the meaning of life differs from man to man, from day to day, and from hour to hour. What matters, therefore, is not the meaning of life in general, but rather the specific meaning of a person's life at a given moment. So after all this ballyhoo about arguing whether the church is true or not, or we should stay, or we should go, or we should reform, or what we should do, all very important questions. But to an individual, the most important question is how I fit in the world, and how I fit in the world at this moment. And those who can find that sense of identity, be it inside or outside the church, will be the healthiest and will be the ones who are most likely to be able to affect change in this world and do what's good. All right, thanks.
I lost the remote. That's great. When I was younger, and I'm not going to tell you how much younger, just to say that it was sometime between the age of birth and yesterday, I was easily terrified of things that didn't scare anyone else. For example, I couldn't wash my hair when I was home alone because that involved closing my eyes, and I was convinced that if I opened them, a very short and hairy man would try to murder me. When I was 23, I was the mother of two small children, the wife of a man who was in school, not this man, just FYI, and working full-time to support our small family. One night I was home alone, sitting on the sofa watching a news program about drive-by shootings in South Central LA, and specifically those that happened to innocent people sitting in their homes. And suddenly, I was very aware that I was sitting on my sofa in front of a large picture window with the street going right by, and never mind that I was living in Ashland, Oregon, population of 14,000, on a street called Whiteman Avenue. But I was so full of terror that I slid off the sofa and crawled upstairs on my hands and knees and got in my bed and laid awake all night until my husband got home. When I was 29, I was disfellowshipped from the Mormon Church for an affair that had become public knowledge. Everywhere I turned, I would hear or see people talking about what I'd done. The first Sunday I went back to church after my disfellowshipment, I saw the looks of judgment and pity on the faces of my fellow ward members. The second Sunday I went back, I wore glasses that blurred my vision so I couldn't see anyone's faces. The third Sunday I stayed home. For a long time, I allowed my life to be controlled by fear. Fear stopped me from going back to school as a young mother. Fear stopped me from speaking up in staff meetings where I was the only woman. Fear stopped me from advocating for myself when my bishop asked me why I felt the need to emasculate my husband by having a career. Fear stopped me from going to church. Fear stopped me from staying away from church. Fear stopped me from speaking up in Relief Society when a woman said the gays were ruining America. Sir Richard Branson said, "The brave may not live forever, but the fearful do not live at all." I posit that fear is a portal to change. When we push through fear, we walk into light. Pushing through fear leads us to greatness and authenticity. I know two things about fear. Fear will show up every time we are on the verge of change or greatness. Most people are afraid. Every person you think is brave is walking through a portal of fear. Now, I live in Southern Oregon, which is home of perhaps the best river rapids in Southern Oregon. A popular activity is to float the Rogue River. And often you'll be in a still section of the river, just lazily floating along, only to hear the rapids around the corner. No matter how many times you have floated the river, that sound can be terrifying because the rapids are unpredictable. And especially as you see them come into view. It's very tempting to cross to the shore and walk along the bank, but shooting the rapids, even if you're thrown from the boat, always turns out to be the best part of any float. Rapids are a part of our journey. Sometimes they may even upset the boat, but navigating the rapids of life brings a great sense of accomplishment and exhilaration we would miss if we got out and walked along the bank. The rapids really are the best part. So how do we get through fear? First, we must have an anchor. Just like a rock climber has an anchor to remain safe, we must anchor ourselves to hold steady on our course through the portal of fear. A few weeks ago, my dad came over to my house to talk to me. I love my family, and I know my family loves me, but my very public actions in Mormon feminism and LGBT allyship in the last 2 years have been stressful for my very Orthodox Mormon family. My dad asked to give me a father's blessing, and in the blessing, he counseled me to remain anchored to Jesus Christ. I love Jesus. I know who he is. He knows who I am. I work hard to know him, and I work hard to be like him. Thinking of him as my anchor as I write, act, and advocate helps me to walk through my fear. When we anchor ourselves to the Savior, we can be strengthened beyond our own abilities and understanding. The psalmist said it this way in the first two verses of Psalms 121. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord which made heaven and earth. Now I know that many of us here might not believe in Jesus or a Savior, and I have a lot of respect for that. But we must find an anchor. We must have an anchor that grounds us while we navigate our fear. Second, we must examine our fear. Let yourself feel fear. Recognize it. Acknowledge it. Sit with it. Examine it. Don't react right away. Explore the worst outcomes and dismiss them. Envision your desired outcome. Then put an expiration date on your fear. Make a date to walk through the fear to the other side. An expiration date makes you accountable. An expiration date will make you brave. And then last, we must get naked and jump in. We must close our eyes, strip off our worries, and step into the portal. When we drop the story we build up around our fear, we open ourselves to new experiences. It really is that simple, just jumping in and walking through. When we do this while facing our fears, our lives are changed forever. On one day in June of 2012, in the future, all right, I was having lunch with my dear friend Matt Workman, and we were talking about the bravery of all those Mormons marching in pride parades. Both of us were staunch supporters of marriage equality, but at the time, marriage equality was only something Mormons like us talked about hopefully in hushed tones and with secret handshakes. Matt and I spoke about the courage and the importance of action and our desires to do better by our LGBT brothers, sisters, and friends. A few months later, I asked a group of Mormon friends to march with me in my local gay pride parade. That day, I walked in front of hundreds of people holding a sign that declared I was ready and willing to fight for their right to marry. I was terrified of what might happen, but I was determined to take my belief into action. marching in pride as a Mormon changed me as a person and as a Mormon. As the hundreds of spectators called out with their approval and declarations of our courage, I saw and felt the love our heavenly parents have for each of their children. Fear fled from me, and my life was changed forever. 2 years later, I would stand on the steps of a courthouse and perform the first recorded gay wedding in Oregon on the day that gay marriage became legal in my beautiful state. Woo! I spoke to the media and declared myself a Mormon who believed in marriage equality. I was afraid of the repercussions of my actions that day, and many of my fears at the time have since been realized. But I was and am unapologetic and without regret. I know what I did was right in the sight of God and anchored in the teachings of Jesus. These days, I can usually take a shower without freaking out that I'll be murdered by Danny DeVito. I can sit on my sofa, not worry about drive-by shootings. I can wear the proper eyeglass prescription to church, and I can look people in the eye without flinching. But I can also stand up for what I know is right. I can speak up for myself. I can make room in my pew for feminists, for my gay brothers and sisters, and for the disaffected and brokenhearted. I can open up my heart to love and to be loved. I can be a conduit for the love of our heavenly parents to each of their children who need to feel loved. I still have fear. Fear waits for me at every opportunity for change or growth. There are days when fear is a big black dog laying at my feet, watching for me to make my next move so she can jump up and follow me. But fear means growth. Fear means light and authenticity. I welcome fear, and now my biggest fear is that one day there will be no more fear left for me.
I just want to point out that I tease John. We argue about feminism all the time, and I say, we can do anything, and now I'm having a man do all the technical stuff for us. Feminism! I want to talk a little bit about shame. The shame of Mormonism, the shame of being a Mormon. Mormons, we talk about Mormon guilt and Mormon shame. I just mean the larger shame that our Mormon people have endured for centuries. Centuries. For almost centuries. I want to give you some facts. It is a fact that Joseph Smith was a good person. Let's look at the evidence. He was, by all accounts, a good father. He was said to be super generous. He would lend his home and his house and the shirt off of his back to people. He was ahead of his time. He called for the emancipation of slaves as early as 1844. And he was a brilliant writer and thinker, regardless of what you think of him. He was brilliant at this. And he inspired people to love him, many people to love him. Joseph Smith was a good person. It's a fact. Joseph Smith was a bad person. Let's look at the evidence. He lied to his wife. He married women who already had husbands. He excommunicated people for violating things he himself did. He was a hypocrite. He did many things that were controversial. He was in and out of courts. He had a criminal record. Joseph Smith was a bad man. Both of those things I just said are true. They're true. Both of them can be backed up by historical record. You've been presented with two truths. What do you do when you are presented with two conflicting truths? What do we do with that? What do we do with that? How do we make sense of that? Is Joseph Smith a bad person or is he a good person? I don't understand. Like, what am I supposed to think about that? The apparent contradictions that I just gave you aren't a matter of perspective. I'm often told, if you would just think more positively, or stop being so negative. This is not about a negative or a positive perspective. This is about something called dualism. And Mormons were really good at dualism. In fact, I would argue it's like a theology in Mormonism. Mormonism and dualism is a really hard thing to talk about without engaging in dualism. Like, dualism is bad. So I'm going to try to avoid that. But I do want to say that Mormonism is laced with duality. I mean, we have heaven and hell and light and dark and good and evil and truth and deceit. And I see so many of my faithful Mormon friends get locked in this sort of narrative of dualism. The church is either true or it's not. You're with us or against us. If you don't like it, you can leave it. Joseph Smith is like, or the church is either the greatest thing that's ever happened or it's the biggest fraud, right? Similarly, when a lot of my ex-Mormon friends are transitioning out of the community, they carry similar narratives. Joseph Smith was evil. The church is bad. The church is a giant fraud. I hear this all the time. These friends of mine take the same narrative that was given to them in the LDS church, and they take that right out of the church with them. Here's the problem with dualism. It doesn't allow for a lot of complexity. And I am going to argue that this is one of the greatest sicknesses in our community right now. This sort of binary dualistic narrative. I have personally seen, at the work that John and I do for Whitefields, we see the pain. We see the trauma that happens as a result of this sort of binary thinking. When things are so binary and black and white, the consequences become more brittle. They become more defined and more jagged. Families can literally be broken apart because of these patterns of thinking. And we're all guilty of them to some extent, and they exist within the Mormon Church and they exist without the Mormon Church. Undeniable is the fact that there are things that are self-destructive. I'm not trying to say that there isn't. So in an effort to not get stuck in this sort of dualistic framework by calling things good or bad, let me define our terms. Carl Jung talks about the shadow self. That is his term for it. And many have taken this to mean like the darkness within us or like our weakness. So like when you're talking about shadow self, it's like all of the bad stuff about you, right? Like I'm greedy, that's my shadow self. Actually, he meant for it to be something a little bit more complex than that. He called it the unconscious. And it's like what Socrates would call the unexamined life. For these purposes, when I talk about darkness, I'm going to first use the Mormon word, how we understand like evil and sin and things like that. And as we move forward, I hope the term to mean something a little bit different. I prefer to look at darkness in issues of contrast, right? Because contrast allows for complexity. There's a spectrum. There's no moral judgment to contrast. We're not saying like red is bad and blue is awesome. Contrast allows for there to be less of a moral judgment. And nature is full of contrasts. We see contrasts everywhere. We like to say, no, like nature is full of light and dark, night and day. No, actually nature is full of contrasts. So, but within ourselves and within our community, we allow ourselves a lot less flexibility. I want to talk about my own darkness for a minute and Mormon shame. This is a topic that's particularly interesting to me because I have some experience with it. When I was 17, I developed an eating disorder, and it was really mild at first. It was just kind of messed up thinking patterns. I had a lot of pressure on myself, but I knew what an eating disorder was. It was bad. It was something bad people had. It was something sick people had, and I didn't want to be sick, and I didn't want to be bad. So the more that I tried to not be sick and bad, the more sick and bad I became, and I resorted to desperately trying to hide this part of myself. And in fact, it grew and grew. And the more I tried to hide it, the absolute more sick I became, till I was so despondent and so full of self-loathing that I believed at the time that my only choices were to either keep going and be a bulimic or kill myself. Because I couldn't stop. And the more that I tried to stop, the worse I got. One Sunday, I told this story before, but one Sunday, I knew Sunday was like the Lord's Day, and I didn't want to sin on the Lord's Day, so I couldn't purge on the Lord's Day. So I made all these rules. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to read the scriptures. I'm going to pack lunch. This is at Utah State. And I'm going to go to Old Main Hill when it's lunchtime, eat my little lunch, and then I'm going to go back to the Institute building, and I'm going to study. And I'm going to beat this, because I can't purge on the Lord's Day. And I did it. I did it. It was so hard. And that night, I came home, and I stole all my roommate's food, and I purged until I passed out. My darkness nearly killed me. And the more I ran away from it, the bigger it got, till it almost consumed me. Especially as Mormons, we view sin, propensities as sin, and we're conditioned to fear them. Sin is bad. We consider it unacceptable behavior. We try to push it away. We want to even avoid the appearance of it, right? This is how we take it. We are afraid that the dark parts of ourselves will take over the light. We see anything as like weakness, as like equated with sin. And many of you are familiar with this. This is Wendy Watson Nelson's book, Not Even Once. It's a book directed at children saying that they can get into this club in the treehouse if they don't sin, not even once, right? This is being sold. It's being heralded. This is out there currently. This is another object lesson I found online. You can find hundreds of these. This is just on a blog. And this woman was trying to teach her primary children that sin is bad and you need to hang out with good friends. And so what she did is she had dye represent sin or bad things. And maybe like the red bull was like word of wisdom problems. And maybe like blue was pornography. And the more dye, the more sin. And the longer you sat in the bowl, the more stained you became. And this is the quote from the object lesson, again, directed at primary children. Before long, the choices became a central part of the definition of his character. He was blue. I think many of us can understand this. This is a doctrine that was drilled into many people like me. I was blue. I was the eating disorder. And, you know, if we can't avoid the sin, like the Not Even Once Club, and we become stained, we want to eradicate them, and we want to eradicate it immediately. Having any sort of dark side sort of, like, insists that we have some sort of intervention. Let's get you in the bishop's office. We got to repent for that. We got to read our scriptures. Let's take a pill. Let's go to a therapist. We have to get rid of this now. There are many aspects of life where a sort of like can-do, change your perspective, let's fix it attitude works. But many researchers who study this say the shadow self isn't one of those. Shame researchers like Brené Brown, Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, Debbie Ford, and many others are starting to find out that when someone reacts to their flaws, their weaknesses, and dark sides with shame, by trying to ignore them, shove them down, or change them without examining them, those flaws, shadows, and weaknesses actually increase, not decrease. Likewise, if the dark side of ourselves are met with compassion, if we allow ourselves to embrace the shadow part of ourselves within us, kind of sit with it for a while, instead of entering the shame cycle, we have an increase of compassion, an increase of understanding, an increase of empathy and wisdom. I think about humanity and how for hundreds of years, we've had folk tales of like the hero and the villain, right? There's the bad guy and the good guy. And we teach our kids that there's bad guys, there's good guys. And now in popular culture, I'm seeing a trend I really like. We're starting to like dig into the villain. Like what makes the villain the villain? What was their childhood like? What made them become this? And although these sort of reflections have always been a part of human history, they've been rare. And I see them starting to permeate popular culture more and more and more, and our psyche, and our writing, and our research. What does it say about us when we are watching the story and we find ourselves empathizing more with the villain than the hero? What does that say about us? Does that mean we are bad? Does that mean we are evil? Does that mean we're condoning evil? I take a far more optimistic approach. I believe that when we empathize with the dark sides of our worlds, and most importantly, the dark sides of ourselves, We are showing a remarkable ability to move towards peace, justice, light, and truth. I grew up believing Joseph Smith was a hero. He was the hero of the story, not only of his story, but the Mormon story. Joseph Smith is the hero of the Mormon story, and in turn, he was the hero of my story. The choices that he made saved me. They saved me before I was even born. I mean, it's weird, these like Christ-like comparisons, but I grew up. Joseph Smith was the hero. And so what that did is that put him so far above me. Here's Joseph, and here's little Lindsay. And Joseph, like, and we like to say, oh, no, he was a man, but all these great things next to Jesus, you know. And I couldn't identify with Joseph. I couldn't identify with him. He was too much of a hero. And so I became the villain of the story. I was the villain. I was the one with weaknesses. I was the one that couldn't get my act together. I was the dark one. Joseph Smith was the hero, and I could never be like that. The first time I went to see my therapist, I told him, I can't stop purging. Like, I can't do it. It's either that or kill myself. That's progress, right? Like, I figure out that I can either, those are my choices. And he said, I'm not interested in trying to make you stop. And I was like, what? No. My behavior is terrible. It's sinful. We have to stop this. Like, this is my temple. Like, I'm defiling my temple. He simply said, your behavior is a symptom of a problem, and your body needs this right now. It's a coping mechanism. Let's find out what the problem is. It wasn't until after great treatment and family support that I learned that to sit with this side of myself. I just took out that shadow side of myself that I resented and I hated and I didn't want to see, and I let it sit there. I stopped trying to stop myself. I stopped becoming obsessed with not being the bulimic. And there was a point where I just said, this is who I am right now. This is who I am, and that's okay. And it wasn't until I could get to that point that I was able to start to reconcile the conflicts inside and I could work my way towards health. That was the key, taking out the dark side and examining it. The more we try to smooth over the shadow sides of ourselves, distract ourselves by singing a hymn or praying for God to fix it or remove it or shoving it in a dark drawer only to like take it out secretly and nurture it when no one's looking, the more powerful it becomes. The only way to address these dark sides of ourselves are to pull it out of the drawer, sit with that at the table, and really look at it. Imagine how much time we spend trying to understand gospel truths. Hours every week. And many of us would say we don't even understand gospel truths. How much time and attention do we take to try to understand the dark shadow sides of ourselves? I can't imagine what would happen to us as humanity if we would do that. I understand it makes us uncomfortable. We don't like thinking that people should make peace with bad behavior. It makes us worry that they're going to continue to enact it and have self-destructive patterns and harm themselves or others. I do not mean to suggest that we should condone violence, injustice, prejudice, abuse, or harm. In fact, I think we should always strive and struggle towards it. But what I'm suggesting in our struggle is we learn to disarm these conflicts by exploring them. When I was struggling, I was too obsessed with ridding myself with the darkness. I couldn't even see that my goals for perfection were causing them in the first place. My quest to be rid of the darkness only empowered the darkness. And it wasn't until I accepted the narrative of perfect or flawed and figured out that that was a false dichotomy, and I looked at myself, and I looked at those sides of myself that were ugly that I didn't want to see, and I sat with them. Perfection is arbitrary. It's changing. Ideals are always changing. As Mormons, we seem to perpetuate a dualistic narrative that makes us feel like we have to be all good or all bad and rid ourselves and become completely clean. This is a sickness in our community, and we need to be gentle with ourselves. And I would suggest that this advice, and yes, I'm saying this, this advice applies to our leadership as well. They need to be reflective of themselves. They need to be just as gentle with themselves as we need to be with ourselves. They too are responsible for perpetuating these harmful rhetorics. They need to allow for more humanness, even in themselves. And in a very ironic way, we could all learn, if we would indeed follow the prophet. For many years, Joseph Smith was deified. We refuse to acknowledge or see the shadow sides of his self. After his death, many members needed to turn him into a legendary figure, a hero, a martyr, someone next to Jesus. They were told these stories because it gave them hope when they had none. They felt deep shame for being Mormons. Mormonism is laced with deep shame. And they needed a hero, and Joseph became it. And they rebuilt their community on the hero of Joseph Smith. But Mormonism is in a different place now. Most of us live much more comfortably and securely than the early Mormons in the Great Basin. We grew up on these narratives. This was a steady diet of Joseph the amazing, Joseph the miraculous, Joseph the near perfect. Those narratives have begun to mar our people. They halt us from not only an unexamined life, but an unexamined spirituality. If we want to claim a true and authentic faith, then we need to accept all of the aspects of the man who established it. We need a new story now. We need a new kind of hope. It's a fact. Joseph Smith was a man. Learning about his flaws has been liberating because it helped me accept my own. Examining Joseph's life completely and honestly might be the key to allow us as a people to explore ourselves. Perhaps if we can allow our own lives the same sort of exploration, if we as a people, both inside and outside of the faith, can allow others, even those we revere or maybe those who cause us harm, to be complex, dimensional, and examined, then it will be a practice to allow ourselves the same things too. May we all continue towards a more peaceful, compassionate, examined existence. God bless.
Hello. My name is Kate Kelly, and this year I've learned a lot about telling my own story. Brené Brown is a scholar and storyteller that Lindsay mentioned and gave an amazing TED Talk, and in it she said, "Courage, the original definition, when it first came in the English language, was to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart." As you can see from this picture, I'm the one in the middle. As a young child, I had no problem imagining myself as the protagonist of my own story. In fact, as clearly evidenced by this photo, that somehow I conned other children, including my sister, into being in, I was at the center of my own story. As you'll notice, there is no king counterpart to my queen character. I was raised by goodly parents, and I was taught that there was no barrier to me being in charge of everything. However, as I grew, I found out that the problem with telling my own story was that every story doesn't end with happily ever after. I found out that most stories don't fit into a neat, prefabricated outline. I remember the exact moment when I realized that the weight of certainty that the trajectory of my life story did not fit the mass-produced Mormon woman story that I had been told and sold as a child. I was on a shabby couch in a Provo apartment during college. I was at BYU, and I was taking a class called Teachings of the Living Prophets. The teacher was Lloyd K. Newell, who's the music and the spoken word voice. And his sultry baritone voice, he urged us to pick an issue or a topic that we wanted to find out about, any topic, any subject, and we wanted to find out what the prophets said about it. Perhaps partially naively, I chose women working outside the home. my mom had worked outside of the home. She was an attorney, and I felt like we had a happy life. And that's what I wanted for myself. I wanted a career. And what I confronted at BYU was a lot of people who really looked down on that. But I was so confused because my upbringing had been so positive. So I read talk after talk after talk, all saying variations on a theme. quote, only in an emergency should a wife secure outside employment. Her place is in the home, to build the home into a heaven of delight. Spencer W. Kimball. Or, it is well nigh impossible to be a full-time homemaker and a full-time employee. Gordon B. Hinckley. I read quote after devastating quote, and I began to sob. I sat on that couch, and I said to my roommate, who was also writing her paper at 3 a.m. the day before it was due, I said, what am I going to do? I realized that the carefully crafted church-sanctioned narrative saw me as this and only this. It saw me as a wife and a mother, the producer of children, the nurturer of children, and nothing else. But my internal compass directed me to this and so much more. The story, as a young college-age woman, it was excruciatingly difficult for me to face the reality that the story I wanted to tell and the life I wanted for myself did not fit the script. I felt alone and at times terrified that I would be forced to live a life that I didn't feel called to live. My humanness wanted to hold on to the script that I had been given. It's just simply difficult to face the unknown, even if it hurts us, because the question mark of letting go leaves us, it's unbearable. All of the prophets have indicated that if I followed my own path, no success could compensate for the failure that would inevitably ensue. I didn't know why my male counterparts had a wide world of choices before them, and I simply didn't. I felt stifled and lonely. Another story was from my mission. On my mission, I had a glimpse of how things could or should be different. I served my mission in Barcelona, Spain, and I was then, as I am now, very assertive. And a lot of the elder missionaries were younger than I was, and I didn't shy away from telling them what I thought. One day, I was in a small branch in northern Spain, and the branch president, because there was so little Melchizedek priesthood holder leadership in Spain, the branch president was just a few years older than we were and had just recently gotten back from his mission himself. He called me into his office one day and said, Hermana Kelly, I have a calling to extend to you, which wasn't unusual. A lot of missionaries had callings. He said, I want you to be in the branch presidency. And I was a little taken aback, and the elders burst through the door, and everyone started laughing. It was a joke that they had planned with the branch president to show me how ridiculous it was that women could be leaders in the church. As I grew, I persevered through my mission, and I loved the experience. But on my mission is when I started thinking about the fact that women in leadership shouldn't be a joke. As I entered into my career, I had the opportunity to meet very strong, courageous, amazing women. One of them's name is Aminatou Haidar. She's in the middle. She's in yellow. Aminatou is from a country called Western Sahara that's currently occupied by Morocco. Although the Moroccan narrative of the story is that Western Sahara is part of Morocco. Aminatou is part of the struggle for independence of her country, and she knows the importance of controlling the narrative. One time when she was returning from the United States, she wrote on her customs form, Western Sahara, and the Moroccan officials told her, you have to write Morocco. And she said, I am not in Morocco. I am in Western Sahara. Because she did that, she was forcibly extradited to Spain against her will and without her passport. She proceeded to have an over 40-day hunger strike in order to return to her country where her children lived. Aminatou understood the importance of being able to tell the truth and be able to control your own narrative. For her, it was literally a matter of life and death. Again, I felt stifled and I felt lonely in my own community. In 1997, Gordon B. Hinckley gave an interview to an Australian reporter named David Ransom. I was 17 at the time. Many have focused use of the word agitation in that interview, but what struck me was this line. Our women are happy. They're satisfied. The reporter then turned to his wife, and she echoed, oh yes, very happy. I felt like this man, who I dearly loved, clearly hadn't heard my story, or any other story like mine. Straight from the prophet's mouth, I learned again what the acceptable narrative is. We are happy. We are satisfied. He explicitly stated that this blissful relationship with the status quo applied to all, but, quote, a little handful, one or two here or there. In my meetings with my own stake president, when he met with me about ordained women, he said I was literally the only woman in the entire stake with concerns about gender inequality in the church. I looked him in the eye, and I said the most diplomatic thing that I could think of at the time. That is not consistent with reality. I guess that was the nicest Mormon thing I could, like, way I could think of saying, you are wrong. I realized that just as I cannot tell the story of all Mormon women, neither can they. Many, many Mormon women would answer the same way with a smile, I am happy, I am satisfied. But I've come to now see that many wouldn't, and many aren't. All leaders in the church, from the president of the church down, need to hear our stories, because we have a very different story to tell. Over the past year, we have had the courage to tell the story of who we are with our whole hearts. It's hard to overstate what an incredible victory for Mormon women and women everywhere this is. For Mormon women, we have had to overcome lifetimes of socialization that taught us loyalty to the institution, lockstep obedience, absolute conformity with the dominant narrative are of paramount importance. It taught us that our voices are less than and so small that they are insignificant. It taught us to fear punishment and to silence our questions, lest we be labeled doubters, sinners, or worst of all, apostates. And so we grew up learning that our own questions were ours alone and not to be shared or discussed in public. This socialization isolated us into the shabby couches of university apartments that felt like tiny islands of uncertainty and fear that we had to live in solitary silence. The internet, helped us to create bridges between all of those tiny islands. It connected us. It helped us to ask questions out loud and helped us explore common experiences and patterns emerging from the telling of our individual stories. We have realized that what we thought of as personal, individual hurts we all suffered alone were actually a collective, systematic experience of sexism in the institutional church. When we launched the site Ordained Women on March 17, 2013, stories came pouring in. I was overwhelmed with inspiration. We had a 16-year-old mind mate who was serving in her class presidency and thought that women should be ordained. We had a currently serving bishop with daughters who thought that women should be ordained. We had a woman in her primary presidency in Utah who thought women should be ordained. These people were not scary outsiders. They were just like me. This connection has been true also of my excommunication. I have heard from countless women who have said that they felt like they were being excommunicated. We experienced this trial together, and we continue to mourn together. But no amount of ecclesiastical abuse can burn the bridges that we have created and the connections that we have made. I discovered that telling my story and making a space for others to tell theirs created validation for those of us who had previously felt so alone. Building the gap between old and new is not an easy, idle journey. It can be painful and it can be exhausting. But wherever this journey of life takes us, whether that's inside or outside of the church, we can find exquisite joy that only authenticity can bring. I will continue to boldly and proactively and proudly tell my own story and encourage others to do the same. I rediscovered my youthful boldness and audacity. I am the protagonist of my own story. There is no king counterpart to my queen character. There is no barrier to me being in charge of myself, of my story, of my own happiness, of everything.
Okay, we're going to move to the question and answer part. We're just going to move the chairs up. And Stephen, can you help us get a mic right here? So you can just line up for questions. We messed up the mics by trying to be fancy.
The journeys of others, but that doesn't mean you have to agree. I think as Mormons, one of the things we really need to learn is how to disagree with people. It's very, very, very hard. I actually gave a workshop about this one time to all non-Mormons. It was a group of legal interns at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and everyone said like one skill they had. And I'm like, well, I'm Mormon, so one of the most keen skills that I've honed is how to disagree with people in a nice way. And so I honestly, this is just what I do. I practice saying I completely disagree with you in a nice way. I mean, I don't hate you for it. I don't feel any differently about you as a person, but I disagree.
Maybe a year ago, there was a family where we gave a talk, and I don't remember a whole lot of the talk, but the one thing that was really stuck out to me was that God has a plan for each of us, a path for us to walk, and that path is as varied as we are. And I love that. This guy is full straight up, so I have no idea where that came from him. But that has stuck with me ever since. And one of the things that I like to do, and I said this in the last panel I was in, is as an active believing member of the church, I try to give as much room for people who are walking a different path as I want. And I want all the room in the world. So you're going to get all the room in the world for me too.
I'm not an evangelist. I'm more of an exhibitionist. So I think everyone just needs to live out loud. I think if we all came out of our collective closets, whatever they be, the foundations of hell would be shaken. And I think that's it. Everyone just needs to be an example. I've been asked to ask you to look towards the camera.
Okay, good. So I think a lot about the nature of reality. I think a lot about our nature of experience of reality, what that means. One idea that I really play with, that I think that you guys, that all four of you were playing with in different ways and grappling with in different ways, is the relationship that narratives, paradigms, and identities have in communities, all four of those, and how when you change one of those, the other three also change. And I would like to hear more specifically about those four concepts of the paradigm, the identity, the narrative, and the community, and how when you change one of those, the other three change. I just would like to hear some of your thoughts about that, specifically with the topics that you discuss.
I think you said it well.
Yes.
I think that it's interesting as you go throughout your journey. I have one of my favorite images I have on my little whiteboard at home is a postcard, and it's of a man that has a huge banner that he's holding, and he's walking through, it looks like the salt flats. He's walking through a desert, and in huge letters the banner says, "I have changed my mind." And I love that photograph. I love celebrating the fact that you've changed your mind, as opposed to being afraid of it or being really intransigent and never changing your mind. So I think I see life much more as fluidity. I celebrate changing my mind about things. There are certain things I feel like might not change, like ordaining women. But I really enjoy that. And I live in a community where for the most part, for my family and my close, loved ones, doesn't change when I change my mind. So I'm very grateful for that, and I hope that we can be that for other people. And I think that's what the Park Sunstone is a place where a lot of people have changed their minds about a lot of things, and we find that community. So I hope we can be that for other people.
I
I just want to talk about stories and narratives for a minute because, like many of you, I mean, I grew up in the narratives of like my pioneer ancestors. I'm one of those Mormons. I know it's Utah-centric, and I apologize. Like, that was Mormonism to me. Like, pioneers, my mom used to dress up like a pioneer and go to EFYs and take us with her. And then we would, like, teach kids how to stick pole and, like, churn butter. And that's how I grew up. Mormonism to me was about the stories of the past. So I'm very much shaped by the narratives of the past. So, crazy thing, there's a lot of stories in the past, and who knew that they weren't all fake affirming? So, when I found that out, that broke me, like, I was like, oh no, I can't believe in God anymore, oh no, I can't believe in the church anymore, because the stories are different than what I thought that they were. But actually, like I said, that I talked about, I really found liberation in the stories. People always say, like, well, what do you do with church history? Like, it's so much what I didn't think it was, and I'm like, it's liberation. If Joseph was perfect, we are screwed, all of us. And so it's fantastic. It's fantastic for the prophets and that stuff, because then we know we can ask questions. Then we know we're not an object for asking questions. So stories to me, I think we need to always be open that stories are not sort of linear. You know, there are multiple dimensions to stories, and those can be really, like, empowering.
As I let my children grow up, I let them take their own path. I didn't really, they knew that their dad was unorthodox and went to Sunstone and other places. Most of them have grown up in a very traditional TVM sense, if you wanted to do that. Since they're all grown and married at this point in time, do I, and I'm on a different path than them, do I wait for them to come to me and ask, hey, Dad, sorry, it was an intellectual question, it wasn't an emotional one. Do I wait for them to come to me and say, Dad, what do you know, or do I just spurn them on a little bit and give them little pieces here and there about maybe the whole, they have not known the whole story and I can tell them part of it all?
I'll just be really brief. I think that, when I first, found out information that wasn't, like, what I was going to talk to, I wanted to tell everybody. I had to tell you all, I don't recommend that at all. I mean, that's constructive. I think as family members, we can support other family members by fostering a community where nothing is off limits in conversation. And I've talked about this before, like in the podcast with John Lynn, but I really hate, as a preschool teacher, I hate potty talk. I hate it. Like, I hate it. And so, like, when my kids talk potty talk, I'm like, no potty talk, no talk potty talk. And then I realize, like, no. Like, why? Like, that's so shaming. Like, we should be able to talk about anything as a family. Like, even if, I grew up thinking it was really naughty to talk about the potty. So, I would say just foster a community, an atmosphere in a family where questioning is, like, part of who you are, and you can get along and disagree with one another. Practice disagreeing. And then that way, if your children decide to find that information, or if they stumble upon it, you can begin to process it with them.
I think when you're, two things. One, we have to be unconnected from the outcome when we share our story. So just because I share my story doesn't mean you have to follow the same path that I did. But I want to be authentic. To me, inauthenticity is like drowning. I can't sit there in a Sunday school lesson and have someone say, like, Emma and Joseph had this amazing, like, storybook marriage. I'm like, okay, that is a scary storybook. Feels very stifling to you the truth, but I think you have to unconnect that from the outcome. Doesn't mean they're going to do what you want them to do. Doesn't mean they're going to post a profile on Morning Women. Doesn't mean that you have to let go of control of the outcome in order to be able to be authentic.
I want to write and illustrate the storybook.
So I kind of got past the Sephora I need to tell everyone, and I'm moving towards that I need to start. start this forgiveness, forgiving the church. It's really hard because it's an institution. I don't know where to direct my forgiveness. So that is that to the 15, is that to Joseph? Who do I direct this forgiveness? Do you guys have any tips? How do I get to that where I'm able to say?
Start with your sender.
A lot of us feel that we were duped, or that we participated in it. Let's be clear. When we accuse the brethren of whatever it is they're doing, we've all participated in the system, and the system has taken over. These guys didn't design it. If you think about these poor guys, they're in golden cages, right? They can't go to Costco without 25 people tweeting about it. But they don't have the privilege of living in Malibu, right? They're like celebrities without sex and drugs. So we are all in the system, right? The system is bigger than us, and it's been around longer than us. And this is why I advocate against the system as opposed to against the people. And once we realize that we're all sort of victims of this, as Lindsay will tell you, then we're better at understanding that. But I think coming to terms with your own Mormon identity and realizing that's part of who you are, no matter what you believe today, I think that's the key starting place.
Yes. One of the best quotes that I ever heard was, I think it's Maya Angelou, and she says, "My anger is good because anger burns out the bitterness." And I feel like we have a culture in Mormonism like angry is bad, contentment is of the devil. Look, you're so dark, Harold. You've changed. You know, we've all heard those. And we need anger. Get angry. Like I said, there's a lot to be angry about. All of our surgery, it's impossible to go through Mormonism, the Mormon Church, and not be bumped and bruised in some way. And be okay with that. We need to sit with that. Like I said, accept it and be angry. Angry is me. The first time I met Jonna Brooks was years ago, and I remember I was wearing my garments and walking, and she's not wearing her garments, and I'm like, what? And I said, Jonna, I'm so angry. And she was like, awesome, yeah, feel that. And it was revolutionary to me. No one had ever in my life told me, feel angry. It was all like, don't feel angry, don't be angry, you know. And so be as angry as you need to, as long as you need to. I would add a caveat, try not to harm others along the way as best you can. And second, I don't know, I haven't fully explored this, but this idea that we need to forgive the brethren, I think that's like a really Mormon construction. Like, we atone it, and then you forgive it, and then you repent it, and then you're part of the repentance process. And then you're Mormon again. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But what I think is, I'm not saying don't forgive, I'm saying maybe just look at it differently. Like John said, I don't really blame the brethren. Like, it's really great when you're angry when I directed at someone. The things that happened to me, they participated in, but it's not their fault. Any more than maybe it's a little bit more their fault than, like, say, my fault, but this is the system that we inherited, and there's, history is freeing to me because it makes sense, why the system is the way it is to me, and that's really freeing to me, but I think if you can learn and practice, I think it's a practice to allow them to be human, and that's really hard because, we want a prophet, and then, even if you leave the church, and you, want a new prophet, and you, want John Larson to be your prophet. No! Look here! John is the right guy. No, don't get me wrong. But look here. And so, instead of trying to forgive them, work here. Look here for direction. Practice that first, and then I think the rest will work itself off.
Oh, forgiveness. I feel in a lot of ways the same way that Lindsay does. I feel like when I started ordaining women, one of the things that was most difficult to me, and one of the reasons I hadn't spoken up before, I was 30, what am I now, I'm 33, so I was in my 30s, and I hadn't said anything about it before. I'm going to talk about it, but not out loud. And I think part of the reason is the most difficult thing for me was looking myself in the mirror and acknowledging that I have participated willingly in an institution that did not treat me as an equal. And I hadn't said anything. And that's hard. So I think part of that work is just taking accountability for your choices and not saying, they made me do it or whatever. Just taking accountability. Like, I did that. I participated. I didn't speak up, and moving beyond that. And secondarily, it's, in my opinion, not forgiving people who do things that are wrong. So I don't have to forgive the people who excommunicated me because what they did was wrong. Period. They're accountable for that. And but that doesn't mean I hate them. That doesn't mean I spend really any of my time thinking about them or wishing them ill will. That just means they are accountable for their choices. They're adult people who are participating in a system that harms other people. They have to take accountability for that. And so I think, at the same time, I don't vilify them or really spend any emotional energy on them at all. That doesn't mean that I, as the victim of something that they've done wrong, needs to forgive. I don't need that for my happiness, and I know they don't need it.
All right, well then, that concludes our session with 2 minutes to spare. I'm an awesome moderator.